This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker.
The mother of murder victim Haley Eichhorn is still waiting, still hoping police will solve the case.
She is missed every single day, and every single day I think about her. There's got to be somebody that knows something, but they just aren't talking.
Ryan Denham reports on the 6-year-old murder near Stanford and a perhaps coincidental drowning death of a man about that time. Plus, a new health needs study of McLean County shows people are getting less healthy. Eric Stock has that. Laura Kennedy interviews author Jim Plath about his new book. And the McLean County Relay for Life is trying to recoup from a rainout. All that and a GLT news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Most homicides in Bloomington Normal are solved fairly quickly. Today, WGLT's Ryan Denham looks back at two cases from 2013 that have left the victims' families without closure and with an unexpected connection.
Life was hard for Haley Eichhorn in the month before she died. The 26-year-old Bloomington woman was caught stealing soap, lip balm, and mascara from a Kroger. A week later, police found her huffing compressed air in a Walmart bathroom. 9 days later, police stopped her after someone spotted her huffing outside a funeral home. Eichhorn told police she was homeless, had no money, and her life sucked. Here's her mother, Penny Eichhorn.
She kind of lived in different places. She was going through a bad time in her life.
Haley was last seen alive Sunday, April 28, 2013. 9 days later, her body was found by a farmer in rural Stanford, about 15 miles west of Bloomington. Authorities say she was assaulted. Her killer has never been found. It's one of very few unsolved homicides in recent history in Bloomington Normal.
It's horrible. I cry every day, and I miss her so much. And it's just like everybody's forgot about her, and that's what it seems like.
Authorities have released very few details about Eichhorn's death in the past 6 years. McLean County Coroner Kathy Yoder and Bloomington Police declined to say even how she died. Penny says she was told her daughter was raped and strangled. Penny wants to know who killed her and why. She also wants to know if it was connected to the death of 35-year-old Siebert Crows of Normal, whose body was found in Evergreen Lake on the same day in 2013 that Eichhorn went missing. Penny says her daughter's friends told her the two knew each other. Eichhorn's family told WGLT that Eichhorn and Crows knew each other as well. Authorities downplay any likelihood of a connection between the two. Here's Bloomington Police spokesperson John Furman.
Well, without, you know, diving into any details or anything, if that were something, credible, our detectives would look into it, obviously. I mean, if it's something that people are talking about, that there's a connection, you know, you would best bet that our detectives would look into that.
Eichhorn and Crows both struggled with drug abuse. Eichhorn grew up in Atlanta, Illinois, attended Olympia schools. Her mom, Penny, says she started doing ecstasy at age 13, eventually got into meth. She was unemployed when she died, had no money. But there was light, too.
She loved her dog, Lily, and I still have that dog. And she just liked to do the girly things, you know, makeup and stuff like that.
The weekend that Haley went missing, Penny says she had a really bad feeling.
I started calling her and trying to get a hold of her, and the phone went right to voicemail, and I couldn't get a hold of her that whole weekend. So then I went to the police station and reported her missing because she always answered my calls because we were pretty close, even though she was going through all that stuff. We were pretty close.
On May 7th, 2013, authorities knocked on Penny's door while she slept.
The coroner came to my door with two police officers. They told me they thought they had found her, and then when I told them about a tattoo she had, they were sure they found her.
Penny says she hasn't heard much from Bloomington Police in the last few years about her daughter's case. Last year, on the fifth anniversary, Bloomington police asked the public to share any leads, tips, or information they might have, specifically about the days and hours leading up to Eichhorn's death. Police spokesperson John Furman says it's still an active investigation.
If anybody has information, we'll definitely follow up on it. So it's not something that we're just putting aside. If we get any new information, any at all, it'll still be investigated.
Even if it's small, police want you to contact them.
You may not think that that's anything, but that may, you know, help bring closure to the families.
If Eichhorn's life was fraying in the days before she died, Siebert Jr. Croze's family says he was trying to get back on track. He was a professional painter and started his own business, SC Painting, and bought his own truck. Father of four loved cookouts, the outdoors, and fishing, and the Green Bay Packers. But he struggled with drugs and alcohol. 5 months before he died, he was charged with felony drug possession after Normal police allegedly found a baggie of cocaine with him during a traffic stop. Here's his niece, Ashley Doige of Normal.
People labeled him as a drug user. So he had his ups and downs with drugs, too. But he wasn't a complete user like that. He was getting his life together.
Croze was last seen Monday, April 15th, 2013. That afternoon and evening, he bought beer twice from a Normal grocery store. He deposited an $1,100 work check and withdrew over $160 in cash from an ATM. Around 10:30 at night, he was spotted on security cameras at a Bloomington convenience store at Locust and Clinton. Police report says he bought cigarettes and a crack pipe there. A Normal detective wrote in a police report that Croze did not appear to be in distress inside that convenience store. Outside the truck, the detective says it's hard to tell from the footage if anyone else is in Croze's truck with him.
He was doing what he was supposed to be doing, his own business, and then everything just went downhill, and he just went missing.
He was reported missing officially 4 days later. His family and friends drove all over central Illinois looking for signs of him. Here's his sister, Diane Schultz of Bloomington.
I always thought that somehow, some shape or form, that I would be able to talk to him again and that I would see him.
Then on April 28th, 13 days after he went missing, a fisherman discovered Croze's body submerged in Evergreen Lake in Hudson at the Kemlara Park West boat launch. After several searches, dive teams could not find his truck in the lake. Then coroner Beth Kimmerling determined that he accidentally drowned. Her pathologist's autopsy found no other signs of trauma. His autopsy report showed Croze had cocaine in his system and a blood alcohol level of 0.106, and his liver had evidence of chronic excess alcohol ingestion. On May 5th, a week after his body was found, the Hudson Fire Department found the truck in the lake, also near the West boat launch. Both doors were closed, unlocked, and the windows were rolled up. The gear selector was left in reverse. The theory was that Croze and his truck somehow went into the lake. He tried to swim back to shore and didn't make it, and the truck's doors closed as it drifted away. Croze's death certificate says he died from drowning in a submerged vehicle. His sister, Diane Schultz, signed off on that decision in 2013. Today, she and niece Ashley Doige don't believe it. They suspect foul play.
Not you, not anybody will ever convince me that he passed because he intentionally did drugs.
Or he drove himself into that lake.
Schultz says she feels she has no closure.
I know my brother. My brother did not go to that lake to kill himself.
The McLean County Sheriff's Department and Normal Police explored several leads suggesting foul play before Croze's death was determined to be an accident. That's according to police reports obtained by WGLT. Normal Police investigated the missing persons case, and the sheriff joined when the body was found. One of Croze's family members showed a detective an email that was forwarded to her, alleging Croze was killed by a distraught husband after being caught with the man's wife in Minear. But that police report shows the email said that Croze's body was dumped in a creek near El Paso and his truck was dismantled at a chop shop. In reality, both were found in that lake. Reports show police also searched the Normal home where Croze and his fiance lived. Police note in reports that several parts of the house had been recently repainted. That's one way to cover up blood splatter. But an evidence technician checked for biological evidence of blood and didn't find anything. Police also got the fiance's permission to search two computers in the home. Authorities told WGLT they spent a lot of investigative staff time looking into things that ended up being non-factual. Ultimately, authorities say the evidence pointed toward an accident. Schultz and Doige say they don't understand why Croze's death certificate says drowning in a submerged vehicle if he wasn't actually found in the vehicle. They also claim Croze's father, who died in 2015, told them that Haley Eichhorn had visited the family's home with Siebert Jr. at least once.
Jr. and her knew each other.
My dad told me that they were friends.
And Haley Eichhorn had came over to Grandma and Grandpa's house before because they knew each other.
McLean County Sheriff John Sandage says his department did not look into any such connection because they had no reason to. Deutsch says she thinks police did not investigate Crowe's case fully because of her uncle's criminal record and history of substance abuse.
And it's in the system that he's had that record, and this is the type of person he was. And here in McLean County, that's how it is. If you have a record of drug use, or this is what you got in trouble, and when that happens, they'll make you as a statistic. And that's not right.
Crowe's case is considered closed. Eichhorn's is still very much open. Penny Eichhorn says she hopes it's over soon.
I just want people to know that she is missed every single day. And every single day I think about her, and so does her brother. And I just want something done so I could get some kind of closure. There's got to be somebody that knows something, but they just aren't talking.
If you know anything about Eichhorn's case, you're encouraged to contact Bloomington Police Detective John Heinlein, 309-434-2672. I'm Ryan Denham.
Support for GLT comes from Zimmerman and Armstrong Investment Advisors, offering securities through First Allied Securities, member FINRA SIPC. Over 30 years of experience, reputable financial management with an independent perspective. Drake Zimmerman has been a proud sponsor of GLT since 1983. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, how the U of I is trying to change the way Indigenous people view health research. A new study shows race and economics are helping drive health outcomes in McLean County. The county's Community Health Council has produced a report similar to its first report in 2016. It identifies access to health care, behavioral health, including mental health and substance abuse, and healthy eating and active living as the top priorities. The study shows while McLean County's numbers are good overall, a deeper dive uncovers specific health risks. Aaron Kennedy, manager of the Center for Healthy Lifestyle at OSF Healthcare St. Joseph Medical Center, and McLean County Health Department Assistant Director Kathy Coverston Anderson were two health experts who worked on the study. Kennedy tells WGLT's Eric Stock how the council made its conclusions.
So the community identified through the survey that the five biggest perceptions of health issues in our community were mental health, with 82%, obesity and overweight being 52%, among others. And then as we pulled other pieces of it together, we also noticed that the important factors that would improve the overall health and well-being of our community would be access to health services at 59% and healthy food choices at 43%. And so combined, you can see how those three health priorities were indicated as being the top three.
And the results are largely unchanged from the last report in 2016. The only real difference was the council specifically named obesity as a health concern 3 years ago. This time it's been renamed as healthy eating, active living. Why the renaming? Has the data changed, or was that intended to be a broader solution?
The top three priorities were not a surprise to us. The only change, like you had mentioned, is the healthy eating and active living piece, and that's just to bring a positive spin into the conversation instead of focusing on the negative.
These three main concerns, access to care, mental health, and healthy living, are all pretty big, all-encompassing concepts, right? So does this report indicate the extent or degree to which these are concerns in McLean County? I guess, in other words, how healthy are we?
There's always room for improvement. And I think as we, as a community, we look at the data points that were shared. And generally speaking, we're less and less healthy as we go throughout the years. But there's a lot to take into that. There's a lot of considerations to take into that that data. But nonetheless, we're still identifying ways to make those improvements and bringing our community together and making a bigger effort to make change.
there was some good news in the data as well. We had over 83% of our county residents actually have access to exercise opportunities, meaning they live reasonably close to a park or recreational facility. And our life expectancy for both males and females exceeded the Illinois rates. For males, it's just over 78 years, and for females, it's 81.8 years. So we had some good news, and within the county health rankings that the University of Wisconsin puts out, for clinical care, we usually rate number one or number two in comparison to the 102 counties in Illinois. So there's some good news, but what we found looking at it and looking closer at the data, that there are some disparities that we were seen that were of concern. And if we looked at, sometimes if we looked just at the county rate, it looked good. But when you broke it down, it really revealed some serious concerns.
So you're talking about demographical differences.
Yeah, in who's receiving health care and when, or not at all. And both in terms of race and ethnic disparities there.
Where are the biggest concerns? Where are the biggest red flags there?
Well, the data, we had to go by the data we had, and we had some age-adjusted data for emergency room visits and hospitalizations. So I have to speak using that data. We had looked at, for example, ER visits for adult and adolescent suicide and intentional self-inflicted harm. We saw that there were higher rates in the Bloomington 61701 zip code and the Chenoa 61725 zip code. And visits to the emergency room due to asthma for all ages, as well as asthma in just adults, were both in the worst 50th and 70th percentile range in comparison to other Illinois counties. So we were seeing it both in terms of some location and zip code specific data, as well as in some disparity data.
And we continue here on Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with Kathy Coverston Anderson, who is Assistant Director of the McLean County Health Department, and Erin Kennedy, who's the manager of the Center for Healthy Lifestyles at OSF Healthcare St. Joseph Medical Center, as the McLean County Health Council has released its community health priorities for the coming years, indicating access to care, behavioral health, and healthy eating and active living are the primary concerns. So going over that data that does show some disparities based on where people live specifically and based on other demographics, does that give you some specifics to work on to address solutions, which I understand the council is going to be doing in the coming months?
Yes, I think what it helps us do as a community, since everyone has limited resources in terms of time and funding, it helps us focus our efforts. For example, if we know that our hospitalization rate for adults with type 2 diabetes, that we have higher rates in our Hispanic and Black or African American populations in comparison to the county rate, that we know that we should probably be targeting efforts to those communities.
And the first report that came out in 2016 was similar to this report. What kind of strategies were implemented then to address this, and has there been measurable progress in any way? Erin?
In each of the categories, there's a large amount of work that's been done to help make improvements and to number one, bring our community together to collaborate on a lot of different programs. So, for example, under the obesity, which was last report, we focused a lot on the food as medicine concept, and we focused a lot on increasing physical activity opportunities, whether it be through workplace wellness or community outreach. For behavioral health, there was a lot of implementation on behavioral health navigators and mental health first aid classes offered throughout the community. And then regarding access, new physician offices were built throughout the community, and there's better collaboration between the medical centers and and clinics. So there's been some good movement moving forward, and it's exciting to see how these three priority actions are, or these three health priorities are going to be moving forward in the next 3 years.
And how do you measure progress, given that this is a long game, so to speak, number one? And number two, as Aaron, you had indicated, the numbers tend to trend in the wrong direction, and they have not just in McLean County, of course, but across the country over a number of years. So how do you know that the programs you're implementing are making a difference, even when these same problems continue to reappear?
I think there's a couple ways to track, and there's not one way is the perfect way, but when we track participation and we track health outcomes, and then we pull it together. But as we start implementing various programs and behavior changes and whatnot, it is interesting to see how we live in a community that people care, and they want to pull resources together, and we want to make that difference. And sometimes that difference doesn't show up in 3 years. Sometimes it shows up in 10 years. And as we do this survey in another 3 years, we hope to see that change. But what we can positively say is we're stronger now than we ever have been as a community. We are, as we pull back layers, we know that it's not just about right or wrong. It's all that gray area that we are starting to address. So, for example, healthy eating, active living. It's not all about portion control and the amount of exercise someone does, right? It's about access. It's about transportation. It's about financial security. There's so many different things that we need to consider, and that's what we're looking at. And over the next 3 years, is let's dig a little bit deeper and a little bit wider and see how we really can make that change.
And how much of a concern is it that is sort of baked into the data? If there were no demographic differences, you could just simply say it's a matter of lifestyle choice, whatever. But the fact that there are clear divisions along race, where people live and that sort of thing, access to transportation and whatnot, that is clearly creating different outcomes.
Yeah, and that could be seen clearly just in some of our census tract level data that you can get through the 500 Cities Project through the Centers for Disease Control. For us in McLean County, only Bloomington qualified for that project. But for Bloomington, we have, for some health indicators, census tract level data, and you can clearly see some different areas of difference in that in Bloomington. But what I'd like to emphasize is that the community health needs assessment, with all the data that's in there, is really a tool, and the whole process reflects our community's values of collaboration, that we really work together well. And with all the different sectors represented in not just the council, but also in those priority action teams, we are far more likely to succeed in seeing some movement in improvements in all those health areas than we are if we act alone or just as one agency. The social determinants of health are immense when you look at housing and transportation, education, income. There's not one sector of society that can just work on that. It's going to take a multi-sectoral effort to really see some movement in that area.
That's McLean County Health Department Assistant Director Kathy Coverston Anderson and Aaron Kennedy, manager of the Center for Healthy Lifestyle at OSF Healthcare St. Joseph Medical Center, with WGLT's Eric Stock. You can see the Health Council's report at WGLT.org. The Council plans to come up with ways to address these health priorities and finalize the plan by February of next year.
The debates have begun. Finding it hard to keep track of the candidates, the campaigns, the issues, the drama? Morning Edition can help, with a sharp focus on the race towards 2020. And if all the politics has you feeling dizzy, don't worry. You still get a steady dose of science, technology, the arts, and human interest stories from around the world. find your perfect balance with Morning Edition from NPR News.
There's also local news. I'm Morning Edition host John Norton. Listen 4 to 9 a.m. weekdays on GLT.
Follow GLT News at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. GLT's award-winning online presence brings you news when it happens, day and night and on weekends. Join the community of users ready to discuss GLT's thoughtful, in-depth reporting and breaking news. Recognized by the Illinois Associated Press for best digital presence, this is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, the Relay for Life in McLean County. A workshop on the University of Illinois campus is trying to change the way research is done on Native Americans and Indigenous people. It's called the Summer Internship for Indigenous People in Genomics, or SING, workshop. The organizers say the goal is to train Indigenous scientists and members of their community in genomics and help ensure genomics research is done in a way that benefits Indigenous people. IPR's Christine Herman spoke with two of the organizers, U of I anthropology professor Ripon Molly and Vanderbilt PhD student Crystal Tozzi. Molly says the use of genetics has led to past injustices against indigenous people.
Right, so there's a long history about anthropologists and scientists going to indigenous communities, getting what they need, leaving, and never coming back. And I learned early on that that was the norm in science and anthropology up until recently. And so I wanted to make sure that I did not follow that same path. And so I now go to communities and work with the communities to figure out what they want to study as well as what we want to study and basically partner with them. And after collecting what I need with DNA samples, come back, get results here in the lab, and then I go back annually to report the results to the community and figure out the next steps.
I'd like to hear both of you talk a little bit about what you see as the benefits for Indigenous people themselves, and you mentioned going to the community and finding out what their needs and concerns are. How do you make sure that what you're doing is going to be a benefit to the people who are like your research subjects?
So right now I have partnerships with a few Indigenous communities in California, Alaska, and British Columbia. Each one of them have different interests on how they want to use DNA as a tool. And so in British Columbia, for example, we're extracting DNA from ancestors from skeletal remains to show genetic links between living community members and ancestors. And they want to use that information in treaty negotiations that they are currently undergoing.
And what about you, Crystal?
Well, I actually work in a number of different tribal communities. Another community I work with is in South Dakota. And a large concern about the community that I work with there is also the environmental component of disease. And I think that too often, especially in today's era of big data, we always like look at the genetic factors and also any health descriptors that we can pull from clinical data. And then that pretty much is the limit of our view and understanding of the health status of American Indians in general, which is not accurate. We live in our communities. We engage with our environment around us. And all of these health disparities and, you know, disparities in resources affect our health status. And it's actually the community members that inform us about the health of their community. And it's able to enrich our understanding and give us a better way to improve the health outcomes of the individuals living there.
You're Indigenous yourself as part of the Navajo. And how does that affect the way you approach this kind of research with the Indigenous communities that you work with?
Well, being an Indigenous scientist, I feel compelled to act as a proponent and also basically trying to mediate their concerns with the interests of the scientific community as a whole. And I feel very compelled to be that sort of supportive activist role in ensuring that genomics research is equitable within our communities, to ensure that genomics research that involves Indigenous peoples will actually benefit us, as opposed to just using us as subjects as we have in the past.
That's Vanderbilt PhD student Crystal Tozzi and U of I anthropology professor Ripon Molly speaking with Illinois Public Media's Christine Herman. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, Laura Kennedy has a talk with an author of a new book in McLean County. The 25th annual McLean County Relay for Life had some weather that forced cancellation of this year's event about halfway through. But it's not over. There's a rain date, August 10th. Nikki Halverson is the Community Development Manager with the American Cancer Society in Central Illinois. She says it's important to finish because people look forward to certain parts of the Relay for Life that are very meaningful.
The Luminaria ceremony had a little bit of a different spin on it this year. We weren't able to put out all of the bags that had everyone's loved ones' names that they were honoring and in memory of. And that's what we want to be able to bring back for this event as well, is for everyone to see all of those bags. And it symbolizes a hope. I mean, everyone has somebody that they have either lost or that they're trying to support. And all of those bags, as silly as it might sound, symbolize hope. And we want everyone to see those displayed. So that's a big portion of what we'll be having on Saturday. But we'll also have the silent auction, which was the big portion that we didn't get to do, unfortunately, because the weather was just not kind to us. As many times as I tried to call in and tell them that I needed to have it very nice, we had a lot of wind and rain, and so we weren't able to protect all of those baskets. So we have, I believe we're up to over 60 baskets now of just random, kind of a little bit of everything, ranging from t-shirts that you can make to a really awesome quilt to we have Star Wars cups from our really fun team that dresses up in all Star Wars gear. And it's just, it's all over the place when you have it.
I hate it when the weather kachinas don't listen. Yes.
I know.
So the Luminaria ceremony, give us a word picture of what that actually looks like.
So in an ideal situation, our Luminaria ceremony happens at dusk, and it is meant to symbolize that kind of darkness, the dark part, the heavy part of cancer, where we have lost someone or the diagnosis is something a little heavier than what we were expecting. And it symbolizes, you know, that portion of Relay, that aspect of their cancer journey. And so everyone buys a Luminaria bag, and it's either in honor or in memory of someone who is either battling or who has unfortunately lost their fight to cancer. And it's illuminated by a glow stick, and it lines the track. And it is one of the most beautiful scenes truly in the Relay for Life event. It's really hard not to shed a tear when you see that. This year we sold over 400 bags, and that's 400 lives that have been affected by cancer. And that doesn't even touch the surface. I mean, and it's a very real picture as to what cancer can do and how many people it truly affects.
What do people tell you about the meaning for that in their lives once they go through it?
It's a huge kind of way for them to really memorialize. I mean, you obviously have that grief, and grief is a thing that never really goes away. And especially with the Luminaria ceremony, you are able to kind of channel that grief into hope. And that is all that Relay for Life is. And we hear that so often, that you don't feel alone during the Luminaria ceremony. And it can sometimes be something that is so hard to go through when you lose someone, or someone that you are close with gets that diagnosis. And to see it lit up with so many others that are sharing your journey, it really is a light of hope, because you see so many people that are there, not only supporting each other, but also supporting the fight back against cancer.
This is 89.1 and WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker, talking with Nikki Halverson of the American Cancer Society about the Relay for Life rain check at the Moose Lodge on August 10th. The money part of it. How much typically gets raised? Where does it go?
So
how do people know that it's really going there?
Yeah, so here in McLean County, we have been lucky enough to raise, upwards of $700,000 with Relay for Life. Right now, our event this year is sitting at around $175,000. A lot of that has to do with, unfortunately, that weather that we had at Relay for Life. And so we're doing this Relay Rain Check event to really bring everybody together and try and kind of make up that lost momentum that we had, because Mother Nature was just not on our side that night. But in terms of where the money goes when you are donating to the American Cancer Society, it's a lot of different areas that a lot of people I think the general public doesn't necessarily know about. One of the really large aspects that we put into is the Road to Recovery program, and that allows a cancer patient who may not otherwise have a ride to treatment receive that ride by generous volunteers that are just offering their cars and gas to be able to give someone a ride. I mean, cancer can be such a, I don't want to use the word burden, but it's tough for the family because you want to be there for your family member or your loved one that's going through this cancer journey, but everyone has jobs and those treatments aren't going to stop just because you don't have a ride. And that is actually the number two, second only to the financial cost of treatment that prohibits somebody from getting treatment for cancer. So that is part of where the money goes to. We also have what we call our Hope Lodges, and then we have our night stays at hotels across the country. That gives all of our patients who have to seek treatment outside of their normal area. So if you had to go up to, you know, like Mayo Clinic, or you had to go up to Chicago and it's a little further than, you know, obviously a hop, skip, and a jump to the local hospital.
Or down to Barnes in St. Louis.
Right, exactly. So there's multiple different places that people, especially here in Central Illinois, we'll have to travel to inevitably for specialists and things like that. And we will give them and their family a free night stay, either through one of our hotel partners or through our Hope Lodges that are throughout the country. So that, and our Hope Lodges take about $1,000 a day just to run. And we have several throughout the country. So that's part of where it goes. And then obviously the big portion that everyone knows about is research. One thing that we're really proud of is that you aren't hearing as many people passing away from cancer. Unfortunately, there still is that, but we have put so much research into, you know, grants and really supporting those researchers that are looking for a cure to cancer, and we're finding better treatment. And so you're able to see that those survival rates really go up.
How much have survival rates changed over the last several decades?
Around 20% since 1994. So I think it's, don't quote me, 26% survival rate in terms of what we have gone up.
And how has that changed the experience of families with cancer, who have loved ones with cancer?
It gives you a little sense of hope to know that there is going to be, it's not as much, I mean, it's still so heavy and it's still so hard to hear the words, you have cancer. And when you think about it and you see the survival rates going up and you see all of the research that is being done, and there are so many other organizations that are also turning, you know, their concentration to cancer research. And there are so many different researches being done that we can't, I mean, ACS has to turn down grants because there are so many people that are finding these new ways to try and attack cancer. And it's just, it's mind-boggling to see how many people are truly putting their day in and day out into finding a cure. And I think that it makes a difference for families and patients to know that there are people behind them that are supporting them and trying to help them along their way without them even knowing who these people are.
If you have raised as much as 700, 800 grand mm-hmm. or so in an event in McLean County, mm-hmm. And you're sitting under two right now, mm-hmm. How much is that going to hurt the effort?
So it's not really hurting us. That's kind of been where we've gone down a little bit here in McLean County. That was at the peak. That was back in, I want to say, the early 2000s that we hit that really, really high one. And it just fluctuates. You know, it's a great problem to have. There are so many organizations that people are giving their money to. And so people are just kind of maneuvering where their giving is going to.
Has the tax bill changed? Has the stagnation of income growth for most Americans changed philanthropy and the way people give?
So I've been in the nonprofit world for a while. and American Cancer Society is not the only nonprofit I've worked at. And we have seen a little bit of a change in giving, not necessarily people giving less, but they're giving to more. So you're not necessarily getting that $100 from one person. You're getting $20 from them because they're giving to five other organizations. And that's, you know, obviously the low side of it. But we are seeing a lot more people give, they're giving by research, and they're very they know who they're giving to and where that money is going towards. And that's something that I think people can be really proud of when they give to the American Cancer Society, because we truly, it is every single meeting we have, it's if we're going to do something, are we being a good steward of our donor dollars? And we make decisions based on that. If we have an activity, it's okay, well, is this going to be a good use of donor dollars, or would it be better to put it in this area? And it's a very conscious thought at the American Cancer Society. But, you know, to your point, we have seen with the tax bills and the way that things have changed, you know, I used to work not necessarily with American Cancer Society, but with the Boy Scouts. We saw that people started meeting with their financial planners, and rather than giving every year, they were giving every other year. And you see that a little bit, but that just means that on those years they are giving, you're seeing an uptick on it. So it's not, it's about even, but it's just in a different way people are giving, if that makes sense.
The rain-delayed McLean County Relay for Life Part 2 will be August 10th from 4 to 10 p.m. at the Moose Lodge. All-you-can-eat spaghetti, auction baskets, raffles, all included. Nikki Halverson is the Community Development Manager for the American Cancer Society in McLean County. This is the 25th anniversary of Relay for Life in McLean County. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The fictional characters we love not only populate our favorite books, but also our lives, helping us learn about the world and our place in it. But who are the most impactful literary characters? An Illinois Wesleyan University professor and two colleagues face that daunting question and have collected a list of 100 characters who have made a potent and lasting impression on readers. WGLT Arts correspondent Laura Kennedy has more.
Jay Gatsby made the list. So did Hester Prynne, Huckleberry Finn, and Harry Potter. Chances are one of your favorites made the list of the 100 Greatest Literary Characters. The new book by IWU English professor James Plath and two co-authors highlights those fictional characters who have captured the hearts and imaginations of readers. When publishers Roman and Littlefield approached Plath about compiling the book, he says he was excited and wanted to do it for the sheer joy of it. Then came shocking news.
As soon as I heard about this as an opportunity from Roman and Littlefield, I thought, this is a fun project. I've got to do it. And I signed on, and shortly after I signed, I found out I had lymphoma. And I was still going to go ahead and power through. But then after 2 years of chemo and treatments, I just, you know, the project got pushed to the back burner, and I couldn't keep up. And so I recruited two of my colleagues, Kirk Kernut and Gail Sinclair. I saw them at an American Literature Association conference in Boston and pulled them aside and said, hey, you want to do this? This would be great fun. And they were like, oh, yeah, it would be fun.
Doing something that by yourself, choosing 100, would be certainly very exciting. But do you think it actually improved the book to have two other voices chiming in and saying, hey, let's consider this person, or have you considered this character?
Oh, of course. And in an ideal world, 100 co-authors would have been preferred, but then it would take 100 years to get that book out because there would be so much disagreement. I mean, we had enough disagreement just among the three of us.
Well, what did you disagree about?
Just which characters should or should not be included. And it's tough narrowing things down. We were also very concerned about things like, okay, are we going for coverage? Are we going for a broad spectrum? Are we consciously trying to make this book about more than just the 100 greatest characters? How do we define the 100 greatest? And so we consulted our editor, our senior editor at Roman and Littlefield, and I said, how politically correct do we have to be? And he said,
oh, really?
Yeah. And he said, you know what? As long as you set your parameters and set your margins, we're good with you doing whatever, because we expect that any book like this is going to be controversial.
Well, let's talk about how you set those parameters. You were looking at pop culture, like Harry Potter, too.
Pop culture, too, yeah. We eliminated things like plays, because Roman and Littlefield hopes to get a volume separately on those characters. We didn't include comic books or graphic novels, and we didn't include children's books. We did include young adult fiction. We did include pop culture, genre fiction, mysteries, westerns. And so we do have a couple that kind of poked through and made our list.
So let's talk about the criteria for selection and how you set that.
Here's our justification. R.R. Boker, the company that compiles a running list of books in print, estimates that in any given year there are approximately 43,000 fictional texts released, whether short stories or novels. And that's been ongoing. Google estimates that there's 130 million books that have been published just in modern history. And so it's virtually impossible to come up with a definitive collection of 100 greatest characters. And once you accept that, now it's like, well, how do we narrow this down to where it's no longer opinion, where it's no longer, well, let's just get the best of this type, but then maybe we have a weaker character. We leaned heavily in the direction of time-honored reader favorites, prototypes, and cultural influencers, characters that somehow have become larger than their lives on the page. And so, you know, we prioritize those that have somehow entered the public consciousness, the collective public consciousness, ones that were influential models for others to follow, and ones that have been so popular with readers that they've become significant, memorable, even beloved. By narrowing it down that way and putting an emphasis on pop culture, we have a lot of characters in the book, for example, that, well, Sherlock Holmes is one. Who doesn't know who Sherlock Holmes is? However, who's read a Sherlock Holmes book? You know, there's quite a disparity. And you get the same thing with who doesn't know who Captain Ahab is. Raise your hand if you read Moby Dick, you know. So those characters have become so entrenched in pop culture that they have products named after them. They have allusions to all kinds of other books. And so that's the direction we leaned, characters that were so big, that have become so big, that they're pop culture now. They're part of culture.
Well, what are some of the characters that you selected that you thought really had to be on this list?
I'm glad you asked that. The short answer is we each got 5 discretionary picks, but those picks still had to be approved by the other two editors. And I put forth one of my favorites is Philbert Bono. I know you're okay, making
I drew a blank there.
A blank face, and that's what most people will do. The reason I could justify, and we could justify including him and not other very colorful characters, is that they made a movie out of Pow Wow Highway by David Seals, and Roger Ebert commented that it was probably one of the best characters he's ever seen in film, and it's the same way in the book. And so
it's a faithful adaptation from the book.
It really is, and because of Ebert's stamp of approval, and the fact that we did have the film, and it grew beyond just an initial indie publication, we were able to justify having a character that somehow burst those pages and became something more.
Were there any characters that were suggested that, I'm not suggesting that it came to blows, but there was controversy with you and your co-authors, with Gail and Kirk, about, you know, we really must include this person and somebody else disagrees strongly? Were there any polite arguments?
Oh, of course, yeah. We met in person to talk about our lists, and we probably argued for quite a long time, and then we went back and forth over email. We had telephone conference calls. Every time we'd go back to it, we'd get a list of more recommendations to go to. We would argue quite a bit. Sometimes the arguments would be over whether a character was indeed the significant one.
Who was controversial?
I don't know about controversial, but we really, really wanted to include an African author or a Caribbean author. And the more we looked at those books, the more we couldn't justify, well, it's not the character that makes this book magical, that makes this book special. It's the circumstance, it's the language, it's something else. And there were other characters that didn't make the cut because it felt like the equivalent of a Hollywood movie that was an ensemble cast. No one character just stood out among the others. So does that mean they're all fantastic and all deserve to be included? Sometimes. I mean, we argued over which character to include from a certain book. Do you include Ahab or Moby? You know? And that turned out to be a little bit of a scuffle. Do you include Jake Barnes or Lady Brett, Ashley? And we went with Lady Brett. And by God, Daisy Buchanan is a lovely character. But Gatsby is the one that...
You got to go with Jay.
You got to go with Gatsby. He's the guy with the suits, the furniture, the
those
movies.
Shirts.
The pink, the ties and everything, and the shirts. And yeah, so those were the types of decisions we faced.
So I would presume you would have the usual suspects, as we have Jay Gatsby and Hester Prynne. But what were some surprises that delighted you that made the list?
Well, you know, I think it was Mark Twain who said that a classic is something nobody wants to read, but everyone wants to have read.
God, I love him.
I will admit that even though I'm an English professor and I've been professing for, you know, 31 years, there are still many classics I didn't get around to reading. One of them was The Tin Drum by Günter Grass. And I was so mesmerized by the character of Oscar Metzerath that I just thought, wow, without this project, I would not have been introduced to him. And that's kind of the feeling we hope that some of the readers will get as they scope out some of these choices, see a character and think, huh, maybe I should read this book.
But I think you'll also probably run into reactions of, hey, why isn't my favorite character on this list? Do you see this as actually the book might be a good launching pad for people to talk about their favorite characters?
We conclude our introduction by saying, let's be clear, these are our 100 greatest fictional characters, and we understand perfectly that readers will agree with some choices and question others. That's okay. After all, isn't that part of the fun and the nature of such lists? So that's one reason we decided to just relax, come up with our list, and think that, yeah, we hope that in an age when so many other things vie for people's attentions, our list can spark a return to libraries and bookstores as much as it prompts debate or controversy.
That's James Plath, co-author of The 100 Greatest Literary Characters, just released by Roman and Littlefield. I'm Laura Kennedy.
James Plath talks about why fictional characters have personal significance to readers in bonus audio at WGLT.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Ryan Denham, Laura Kennedy, and Eric Stock. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is GLT.